Anyways, it's our third class. We are in the book of Peter. Over the last two classes, we've been going over, of course, the author, which we know, of course, is Peter. We talked about that at length. We established a date, 63 to 65 AD. We talked about that at length. And then, of course, last week, we talked about where Peter had written this book from. We talked about, was it possibly Babylon is literally stated there in 1 Peter chapter 5, or did we talk, or was it possibly, was Peter being cryptic in his regards of 1 Peter chapter 5, and did he perhaps mean another place? And as we had talked about at some length last week, I was hoping we did not belabor the point too much, but we talked about that the evidences that are contained both internally and externally, that it really points to Peter being cryptic, and the place of origin of this letter is the city of Rome. Now, if you recall, though, as we ended that class, I said specifically that I'm not going to be dogmatic about it. I don't think you should be dogmatic about it either. And that regardless of where Peter penned this letter from, if it's literally Babylon or someplace else, Rome, as we'd indicated, that it does not change what he is writing about. And so we're going to talk about that a little bit more this morning as far as who he's writing to, where he's writing from, or not where he's writing from, but to whom he's writing to, a little bit about what the book is about. And then we're going to talk about Peter this morning. And so if you recall, a couple weeks ago, I had given you the assignment to talk about Peter. Tell me what you know about his life, what the scriptures unveil to us about his life and what he was about. And to define him, give me some characteristics, some strengths and weaknesses. I hope you did it because I'm going to call on you. Because if you remember a couple weeks ago, I said what constitutes a good Bible class is not me standing up here for 45 minutes talking and you sitting there and not engaging in any type of fashion or form. And even though I really haven't been true to that over the last 2 weeks, I know it's been me doing the talking, but I am expecting some participation. And hopefully, if you do raise your hand, I'm not going to overlook you for 10 minutes like I did Glenn last week. And again, I apologize for that. I did not mean to do that. So anyway, so before we get started, if you would bow your heads with me. And Jimmy, would you lead us in prayer, please? Okay, so if you did miss last week and you're asking, okay, well, what's this about? We're talking about, you know, in regards to Peter's place of origin of writing this letter. Is he being literal with Babylon or figurative or cryptic with the city of Rome? The only thing I can say is ask me after class and I'll talk to you about it, because we did go over quite a bit of material in regards to that. And again, I was trying to proceed as cautious as I could because I didn't want to throw so much material at you that when it was all said and done at the end of class, you couldn't make the forest from the trees. But hopefully I was able to present that in a fashion so that it does make sense, both looking at the internal and external evidences of that. But again, as said earlier, not going to be dogmatic in it in regards to that. If you still think it's literal Babylon, fine. Or again, if you think he's being cryptic, fine as well. But it doesn't take away from the message that is contained within the letter. Okay, so we talked about that. And the only other point that I'll bring up, and I'm just going to bring this up because we're not going to address it this morning. We will address it eventually as you get into 1 Peter chapter 5, but I might ask you this question. If you do believe that Babylon is being, that as Peter mentions Babylon, that he's being literal there. Now remember last week I argued a little bit that what Peter is doing is he's being cryptic. He's using a literary device, okay? But if you think he is being literal there in 1 Peter chapter 5, then I would also suggest to you that as he states there, she who is in Babylon, the she, who is the she referring to? Well, if Babylon is to be taken literal and not as a literal device, then I will also humbly submit to you, so is the word she. But we'll talk about that more as we get into 1 Peter chapter 5, but I want you to think about that and consider that eventually when we get there. So, with that said, again, we have Peter the author. We have the date of around 63 to 65 A.D. We talked about the place of origin of writing, possibly Rome, if not literally Babylon. And so that brings us to the question of, to whom is Peter writing to? And if you haven't done already, 1 Peter chapter 1 there, in verse 1, mentions, who are the recipients of this letter? Galatians, all these provinces, right? Where are these provinces located? Asia Minor. What is that present day? Good. Sometimes it is referred to as Anatolia. So here we see that these provinces here that are located within Asia Minor. And keep in mind also as well, as we had mentioned in previous classes, that these same areas also constitute the seven churches of Asia Minor that the letter is written to in the Revelation, as we read about there, given to John. So we see that these provinces are here in Asia Minor. And as we had talked about a little bit over the last two classes, there is the why. And remember, I had mentioned that, you know, a lot of times in studies that teachers might try to look for maybe a specific word or a key word that they might use to entitle a book or to focus on. And remember, I said it's not necessarily for us going to be a word, but as we go through and we read of all the things that are being talked about in 1 Peter, and there's a lot of things, and even as we move on eventually into 2 Peter, as we go through and we read these chapters, there's so much information. There are a lot of things that are being talked about, but what we do want to remember and focus on as we read here in 1 Peter, that he is writing to these churches in these provinces of Asia Minor. And what we do know for a fact is that these churches, these Christians, are being persecuted, okay? That they are going through trials. And we talked about, you know, 63 to 65 AD. We talked about the significance of Nero and the persecutions that they endured. And even though somebody might say, well, you know, Scott, those persecutions that Christians endured under Nero was more focused in the city of Rome. But you got to remember, though, that Nero is setting a very dangerous precedent, because as he is literally torturing Christians, and why is he doing that? He's trying to shift the blame to them, because he was the one that burned the city of Rome. But he's trying to cast the blame on the Christians. But what he's doing is he's setting a dangerous precedent, because what he's then telling the rest of the rulers and governors within the empire of Rome is that, you know, that under the slightest pretext, persecute Christians, and that is going to spill over into other areas. And as we know, as we read the book of 1 Peter in these provinces, that they are enduring trials, and they are going to continue to endure trials and persecutions. So with that, that is the why. So if you look at 1 Peter, and this is just it, we're going to get into this next week. But if you look at 1 Peter chapter 1, starting in verse 3, again, this is just to whet your appetite a little bit of what we are going to be talking about, especially next week as we get into chapter 1. But there in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming of the salvation that is ready to be revealed in the last time. In all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls." Now, as we go through and continue in 1 Peter, we are going to be, you know, talking very specifically about some certain verses, and we'll keep referring to them, going back and referring to them as we continue to move forward in the book of Peter. But these are some verses here, especially verses 8 and 9, as we've just read there in concluding there. We're going to be referencing these verses quite a bit and going back to them. So as we look at it, and just as what we're going to discuss a little bit next week, I would pose the question to you this way. I would ask you this. How valuable is your faith? How strong is it? What does your faith mean to you? How valuable is your religion? Is your faith so valuable that no matter whatever circumstances, whatever difficulties, whatever problems that you are facing in your life right now? And the one thing I want us to understand is we're going through in 1 Peter and we're talking about, we might specifically be talking about persecutions, but when we talk about trials and tribulations, they come in many forms, right? I mean, I'm just not talking about, I mean, sometimes we say persecutions, tribulations, and we automatically think, okay, of what the Christians suffered under Nero or under Domitian or under Vespasian. I mean, we think about that and people giving their lives for their faith, but we do understand and know that when it comes to trials and tribulations, that they come in many shapes or forms. Sickness, family problems, you know, health, maybe work-related issues. I mean, there's a lot of things that can come up. So when I ask, you know, how valuable is your faith? How strong is your faith? How strong is your religion? How valuable is it? My question is it so valuable to you? Is it of such a high worth that no matter the circumstance that you face in your life, the trials that you are currently going through now, is your faith so valuable that no matter what you're going through, that you do not allow those circumstances to take away your joy? Because as we'll continue to talk about next week, we know that what? These Christians were going through difficult times, but as Peter says here, no matter the circumstance, what are they? They're joyous. Now, I ask you this question because I ask myself the same question. And I find myself, if we're going to be real, if we're going to be honest with each other, that I'll tell you that there's been times in my life where I've faced a situation and I've let it get the best of me at times. I've letting it take my joy away from me at times. Am I the only one? Can you relate to that? I think hopefully each and every one of you can. So as we go through and we talk about the why of this book, we're going to find ourselves constantly referring to verses 8 and 9 there when we talk about what we go through and why we go through it and what should be the outcome of it. I say this because any time that you read in the scriptures, in the New Testament, when the church is facing persecution, when the church is going through trials and tribulation, what is the result? It grows. Go to Acts 5. Take a look at Acts 5 real quick. In Acts chapter 5, in the last few verses there, verses 40 through 42, we know that according to Acts chapter 5 that the Sanhedrin has confronted the apostles and again have told them to not proclaim or to preach Jesus, okay? So the outcome of this is quite simply there in verses 40 through 42. His speech persuaded them. They called the apostles in and had them flogged. Now, we could just very simply read over that, had them flogged, right? But I'm sure all of us are familiar with that when they said they had them flogged, what was involved with that process, okay? Had them beaten, okay, to a bloody pulp, okay? Had them flogged. Then they ordered them not to speak in the name of Jesus and let them go. The apostles left the Sanhedrin, rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. Day after day in the temple courts and from house to house, they never stopped teaching and proclaiming the good news that Jesus is the Messiah. So here we see that the apostles are flogged for proclaiming the name of Jesus. And what do? They keep on going. And notice that they were counted worthy for suffering for the name. Wouldn't you equate that to the same thing as what Peter says in 1 Peter when he says, despite, you know, everything that you go through, what? You are joyful. You are joyful. Just not there. Just turn over a couple chapters to Acts 8. Now, we know in Acts 7 we have Stephen who dies for his faith. He is the first martyr. But we see again the outcome of this. The church is being persecuted. And there in Acts chapter 8, it says, the first verse there, "And Saul approved of their killing him," that is Stephen. "And on that day, a great persecution broke out against the church in Jerusalem, and all except the apostles were scattered throughout Judea and Samaria. Godly men buried Stephen and mourned deeply for him, but Saul began to destroy the church, going from house to house. He dragged off both men and women and put them in prison." Notice verse 4. "Those who had been scattered preached the word wherever they went." So here we see that the church is persecuted. Stephen dies for his faith. He is the first Christian martyr. And again, what is the result? The church grew. So again, you're going to say, okay, Scott, what's the point? We've already established here that in 1 Peter, what's happening to Christians? They're being persecuted. And I want you to notice, too, that as Peter is writing this letter, that he's not only in 1 Peter, as he's writing this letter, not only is he's telling them, commending them for enduring what they've endured. So he already knows that they're doing that. But then he's going to continue to strengthen them and encourage them to stay down that same path, to stay down that same road. And so what the point is this morning that I want to bring to your attention is that any time under persecution, the church has grown. And it's no different for the churches in Asia Minor. Here's the point. We read in Acts 5, church is persecuted, it grows. When we go to 1 Peter and we look at these churches in Asia Minor, and even though we know that they're going through these persecutions, okay, we also know that the church is growing. Is anybody in here, and I'm sure a lot of you are, anybody here familiar with the letters between Pliny the Younger and Trajan, the emperor of Rome? Yes? No? I think some of you might be. Now, for those who are not, you might say, okay, well, who's Pliny? Or if you're from Britain, you'll say Pliny. Okay, so Pliny or Pliny. We tend to say Pliny here in the United States, but in Europe they say Pliny. Pliny the Younger is a governor, and he is a governor of Bithynia, which is one of the provinces that we just read about in 1 Peter chapter 1, okay, to the churches there. He is a governor of Bithynia, and he's governor from about 110 to 112 AD, okay? That puts us approximately, because remember, our date for Peter is about 63 to 65 AD, yes? So it puts us about 50 years after the penning of this letter. Now, what's interesting is that with Pliny, we have all kinds of his correspondence that are kept. Again, him being governor of this area. And he writes quite a bit to the emperor Trajan, head of the Roman Empire. And he's confronted with a problem. And the problem is he's speaking to Trajan. He goes, "Trajan, I've got a problem. I've got all these Christians in my province, and I really don't know what protocol is for dealing with these Christians. Now, what I've been doing is I've been calling them in, and if they say they are Christians, then what I do is I punish them. And typically the process is he would punish them 3 times, and then usually he'd put them to death. But even he's not quite for certain that this is the right protocol," which is interesting because it tells us that even during this time period of Roman rule, that there's not an official policy towards Christianity. It's not against Roman law to be a Christian. But certainly they do not appreciate what they would call the superstition or the practices of Christians. But he writes to Trajan, he goes, "Man, I've got a problem. I just don't know how to deal with these Christians. I mean, what should I do? This is what I've been doing. You know, if they say to be Christians, then I'm punishing them, even putting some to death. But if they renounce Christ and if they embrace Roman deity, then we forgive them and then they continue on life as usual." But it becomes of such a problem that, listen to this, because I wrote down part of the translation. In fact, this is translated by William Melbeth, who's very well respected. And here in the translation of Pliny's letters to Trajan in regards to Christians in Asia Minor, just 50 years later, after this letter is penned after we know the persecutions and trials that they are going to go under, and knowing that when we read in the scriptures, when the church faces these kinds of persecutions and trials, we know the outcome is growth, right? Listen to what Pliny has to say to Trajan. He says, in talking about Christianity, he says, "For it appears to be a matter highly deserving your consideration, more especially as great numbers must be involved in the danger of these prosecutions, which have already extended and are still likely to extend to persons of all ranks and ages, even both sexes." That's Christianity, right? God is no respecter of persons. Okay, again, he's talking about Christianity, even both sexes. In fact, this contagious superstition, that's him referring to Christianity, is not confined to the cities only, but has spread its infection among the neighboring villages and country. Nevertheless, it still seems possible to restrain its progress. That's what he said. Now, according to most scholars, by the time you get to the end of the first century, it's considered that within Asia Minor, by the first century, into the first century, there's my great handwriting again. Somewhere around, they believe, 80,000 Christians by the end of the first century. In a decade, as we get to Trajan and to the letters of Pliny, they think it's somewhere around 100,000 in 10 years. By the time we get to the second century, to the end of the second century, Christianity is the predominant religion in Asia Minor. So I ask you, when the church is persecuted, what happens? It grows. And we see the evidence of that growth. I mean, the numbers don't lie. The letter doesn't lie. It's translated. Rome saw Christianity as a threat. Now, unfortunate, I mean, Jesus told Pontius Pilate pretty clearly that what his kingdom was what? Not of this world. Okay, but Rome saw Christianity as a threat, this superstition. But in turn, what we see is we see people, Christians, living their faith, a faith that was so valuable to them that no matter what the circumstances were, no matter how difficult things got, they did not back down on their faith. And the result is evidence with the numbers that we have. Proof is in the pudding. The proof of what we see taking place here in 1 Peter translates over into the history that we have in the numbers. The church grew and the church was successful regardless of what the Roman Empire tried to do to it. That makes sense? Any questions?
Let me just add up. It's kind of confusing because if I was writing a letter about Americans and really I was talking about people in Bolivia, it just wouldn't make sense for me not to specify if I'm talking about Americans. Mm.
Well, no, he does. He specifies the provinces within Asia Minor and Asia itself, which is a province within Asia Minor. Remember, during the Roman time period, you had Asia Major, which is what we consider the Asian continent. You're talking China and India and all those places. And then you have what was Asia Minor or the Anatolia Peninsula. And then within that, you had the province of Asia itself.
Well, that's what I'm trying to find, is references to Anatolia and antiquity, which is kind of difficult. So I'm still up in the air about that one. And the other thing is you mentioned letters. And that's, to me, that's one of the best ways to cut through everything, is if you want to know the politics of a specific time period, read those letters.
Yeah.
Which give them a lot more than I would reading history books. An example would be, if you want to know about Napoleon, read his letters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing I would encourage people to do, is read letters of history.
Well, and the thing is that, not to, you know, get too far away from that, but add a little bit to it, these letters of Pliny are interesting because it talks about, again, Not that there was an actual official Roman position yet on Christianity, because again, they had passed no administrative laws outlawing Christianity yet. It doesn't come till later, but obviously it's a problem and it's a nuisance, and it's being handled a little differently in each province. And here, that's why Pliny is writing this letter to Trajan, to try to figure out, hey, what, you know, I am persecuting and I have killed some Christians, but really, what should I do? What's the proper protocol? What's interesting about in these letters as well, not only talking about, you know, the problem of Christianity, but he also goes on and speaks about what Christians were about. They met on Sundays. They met usually before the sun rose. They partook of a common meal. Does any of this sound familiar to what we do today? They partook of a common meal. They met on Sundays. And they took oaths upon themselves not to lie, cheat, steal, honor their word. And so, again, we think, you know, those are the common values that we have as Christian, as God has instructed us to do. So the letters are important, not just for the sake of talking about how Christianity posed a problem to the Roman government, but also Pliny talks about, again, who, you know, what these Christians were about. And you might say, okay, well, if that's how he describes the Christians, you think, what's so wrong about that? But you have to understand that they did at this time. And that's contrary to a lot of what some so-called scholars seem to suggest. And what they suggest is, well, you know, when these books were originally written, like these New Testament books, you know, Jesus himself and his apostles, you know, he never claimed to be deity. That was all changed when the redactors came later in the second and third century. And then they try to attach some type of mythology to Jesus that they said, okay, well, he's now proclaiming to be God, but that was never Jesus' claim in the beginning. You go to look at the letters of Pliny, and what Pliny says is that they are worshiping Christ as deity, and why they held this as being superstitious is because it was not the same way in which the Romans worshiped their gods. It was contrary to that. So to them, it was superstition. In fact, really, it was a derogative term looking down upon Christians because they thought, oh, this is a new religion. It's not like the old ways in which we worship our Roman gods. But that's, you know, the importance of these letters of Pliny. And I would suggest, go online, you can actually read. There are, in fact, we have all kinds of correspondences between Pliny, other governors, and Trajan as well. But specifically, these ones in regards to Christianity are very, very interesting. So I encourage you to go online and to read those. And again, that's what I did, is pulling out a section of that letter that's been translated so we understand that relationship. So, any other questions or comments? Okay. But again, we don't talk about that too much. We'll get into it more about the whom and the why as we get into the book. But it's important that, again, we establish this and look at and understand where the Romans, how the Romans were viewing the Christians, not only during the time Peter was penning this letter, but even later on. So, any comments or questions? Yes, sir. See, I called on you right away as soon as you raised your hand. Mingled with. Yes. And if you're referencing to the kingdom of God and the church, and as we just talked about, yes, I do believe that's an accurate application. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's right. And eventually we know, just because we have history, that Rome falls. And really the reason why Rome falls, we could talk about the Visigoths and the Vandals and the outside raiders, but like any empire, it truly falls from its own weight. Okay? So, but I don't think we necessarily need to get into the reason why that is. Any other questions or comments? But no, Daniel chapter 2 is exactly. And the point is that no matter if it's the gold, the silver, the bronze, or the iron mingled with clay, the point is that those, all of those kingdoms and what they represent are going to be destroyed, and you're going to have what, that mountain that is going to consume the entire earth, and that's what you have. And This is a good reference for that. Yes. Anything else? Anybody? Okay. Yes, sir. That's correct. So, anything else?
Sometimes you may have a pro, call them a czar. You know, like from letters, I kind of, it appears in letters that Tiberius is pro-Christian, for example. And in a long way around, Titus also.
Mm-hmm.
So, it would seem to me it would almost be like politics of today. One that's pro and one that's against, rolling in time.
Yeah. There's actually, when you go through and you look at Roman history, there's about 10 or 12 significant persecutions against the church over a period of about 300 years. But as many as, you might say, and of course that's a lot of persecutions, you're talking about a time span that covers about 50 or 55 emperors. There are, though, within that time period, some emperors who tend to be more sympathetic towards the Christian cause, and so you don't see such a high rate of persecutions, but yeah, depending on the history. But you know, there's some things that, you know, you might question, and again, not to get sidetracked, but you know, again, some people might question, you know, the history of Constantine and Christianity and from that nature, but again, we won't get into that. Any other questions or anything? Okay, Peter. Let's talk about Peter. Let's talk about your assignment, okay? So, important as we talk about historical context for the book of Peter, of course, I think it's important that we talk about the man and who has penned this letter, okay? So, what do we know about Peter? What does the Bible tell us about Peter? Give me a fact about Peter. Okay, his occupation, he was a fisherman. Was he in business partnership with anybody? Who? James and John. Very good. Now, I will make this comment, and I have been guilty of this, I think, myself. You know, we always talk about Paul and his intellect, correct? Rightly so. But I think sometimes we just kind of assume or allude to the fact that, you know, Paul is a highly intellectual, and therefore Peter and some of the other disciples are, could I use the word dumb? But they're not. Now, it is true that of the disciples that we talked about, were any of them professional religionists? Were they theologians by trade? No, they weren't. But I'll tell you this, though. Peter was a fisherman, and he owned a business, and he was in business with James and John, okay? Now, I just say this from my own personal standpoint about owning and running a business, and for some of you others in the audience, owning and running a business, that's not the easiest thing to do, okay? It presents a lot of challenges, and if you think him being a fisherman on the Sea of Galilee, I would tell you this, I feel quite comfortably in saying that I'm sure there was a lot of, as he's a fisherman himself, that he's got a lot of competition as well. And I'm telling you right now, in order for you to run a business like he did with James and John, it takes somebody who's smart, we might say street smarts, savvy, in order to run a business and to be successful at that. We know that he is successful at that. To get into one of the other points is that he had a home, correct? He had a home, all right? Where was he originally from? No. Very good. I spell that right? Not a very good. S-I-D-I-A? A-I. D-I-A? D-A. You people are helping me out. If it's more than three letters in a word, I'm in trouble, I'm telling you. Bethsaida. Okay, so he's from Bethsaida. But as somebody mentioned, where does he eventually make his home? Pernum. Do I have to spell that too? Capernaum. A-U-M? Thank you. They're all in the region of Galilee. Okay, so he's from Capernaum. What else? Or he lives in Capernaum. He has a house in Capernaum. I know some of you, you've been to Peter's house in Capernaum, right? Allegedly, it's a tourist trap, okay? I've been there. I know a few of you have been talking to you. They have no historical evidence or merit that this building, I don't even know what kind of style of architecture it is, this modern-looking facility that they built over this dugout hole that they say, oh, this was Peter's house. That there's no, we have no merit to that whatsoever. It's just, like I said, it's a tourist trap. But we do know that he had a house in Capernaum. Okay? What else do we know about him? Yes. He was a little rough around the edges. Okay, and you know what? That's perfect, because then we're going to get into his characteristics and traits, because there's a lot of them. Who was his brother? Who was his father? John was his father. What was his birth name? What was it changed to? Peter's Greek. What's Aramaic? Cephas. Very good. Okay. What does Peter or Cephas mean? This gets into his characteristics and trait. When I say Peter, do you automatically think of a rock? Maybe a rock you could throw through a window, maybe? Times. Okay. What else do we know about him? He's married. Very good. How do we know that? What about his mother-in-law? She was sick. Who healed her? Peter, Jesus healed him in the town of Capernaum. How else do we know that he had a wife? Very good. 1 Corinthians 9, I think it's verse 5. Paul talking about his rights as an apostle and mentions, you know, Peter. And when Peter is traveling, right, presenting the gospel, teaching, encouraging the brethren, who does Peter take along with him? His wife. So we know that he's married. Now, there's a lot of history that is very questionable in regards to Peter's wife. So we don't really mention her as far as information goes, because it's kind of all over the board and it's very inconsistent. Like, for example, what was Peter's wife's name? It depends on what account you read. I don't know. Mrs. Peter, yeah, that was one. Sister, I mean, we call, you know. Concordia, Perpetua, I mean, there's all kinds of different names. There's history that say that she was with him in Rome and died with him as a martyr in Rome. There's some say that she died later. But again, we get so many different accounts. We just don't know. We don't have anything valid to point and say, yes, this is what we know about Peter's wife. But we do know that he was married and he had a wife and she accompanied him when he traveled. Okay, so we do know that. Anything else we know about Peter? We know anything about his death? I'm sorry, say again? Peter or James? I think that's a reference to James. So, double check that. What about his death? Now, we talked about, secular history talking about, you know, him spending his last days in Rome and being martyred in Rome, okay? But what do the scriptures say about his death? It would be violent, that he would, he said that he would be martyred, and that in his martyr, that it would, we know he'd be martyred because it would glorify God, okay? Now, you mentioned what? And reason for what? Why was he crucified upside down? That's right. Now, that is a tradition. We don't know if, really if that's historically accurate, even though a lot of people reference it, and a lot of old church fathers reference it. But again, we don't know quite for sure. But we do know, according to what the scriptures tell us, in John chapter 21, that Jesus says what? In fact, let's just go there real quick. We'll read those couple verses. Look at John chapter 21. And notice that this is stating kind of, or during the time in which Peter's kind of reinstated. Because remember, what does he do before the Lord is crucified? He denies him three times. And here in John chapter 21, Peter, you know, remember, he's going to ask him, do you love me? And of course, he replies, yes, Lord. And Jesus responds, feed my lambs, feed my sheep. So there it says there in verse 17, the third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asks him a third time. And would it be fair, as we'll get into in just a few minutes, would it be fair to describe Peter as being an emotional creature? I think it'd be very fair. And what this ultimately points to is that Peter, whatever his strengths and whatever his weaknesses are, guess what? We identify with them. I mean, really, that's the point. We're going to get to that in a second. But he said there, "Do you love me?" There, continuing on in verse 17, he said, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." Jesus said, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands." And some believe that that's a sentence denoting that when they stretch out the hands for crucifixion, possibly. "And someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go." Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." So even though, again, we can't specifically say that he died by crucifixion, it's possible. We do have some history there that suggests that. But what we do know for sure, taking away from John chapter 21, is that he is going to die. He is going to die for his faith, and it will glorify God, as the very words of Jesus tell us. Okay? Anything else that we know about Peter? Have we overlooked anything? Mm-hmm. He was. All right. So let's talk about Peter the person. Yes, go ahead. Very good. In fact, as far as a job description goes, being an apostle, we could reference that in Galatians chapter 2, Paul says that he was an apostle and preached unto the Gentiles, and what did Peter primarily do? He taught and preached to the Jews, okay? We might get into that eventually, but we talk about Peter, okay? We'll talk about his strengths and his weaknesses. Or we might say positive and negatives. Okay, give me a trait about Peter. Something that, you know, how would you describe Peter? Give me one. Zealous, very good. You have an example? Okay. He was a leader. How so? He really does, in those first few chapters of Acts, seem to be the spokesman of the 12. Doesn't mean he's the most, you know, important. Certainly, that's not what it means. It's not what it's implying. But in turn, though, he seems to be a leader of the apostles, speaking when the time is needed to be spoken. Okay, so he's zealous. He's a leader. What else? He's impulsive. Should we put that over here? That might tie in with his zealous a little bit. Okay. But I put zealous down as a, you know, that's a good thing. He's both. Okay, so he's impulsive. What else? He's what? Quickest talk. Impetuous? Is that a fair word? Oh, okay. Okay. The quickest. And it's, even when Jesus first meets Peter, that time Simon, and he says, you know, that I'm going to change your name to Peter, which, you know, implies that, I mean, even before Jesus met Peter, he had a plan for him. I mean, exactly so. But we might say, we might say impetuous from one standpoint. And then over here, though, again, we might talk about he's quick. He puts things together. Okay, what else? Are we out of time? What else? Go ahead, Paul. Inquisitive. Very good. Yes, Steve. That's right. He's a study of contrast. He says, Jesus washes their feet, and he said, Lord, what? Don't wash me. And Jesus says, if you don't let me wash me, you'll have no part of me. And then what does he say? Wash all of me. I mean, you know, can you relate to that? I mean, can we say an emotional roller coaster at times? I can relate to that. 0 or 100. Somebody else have their hand raised? Okay, this is what I want you to do. We're going to talk about these characteristics a little bit more, and if you raise your hand and I miss you, sorry, get your hand up next Sunday. I want to make sure everybody gets some input in on it. We'll talk about Peter the man a little bit more, his characteristics, and then this is what I want you to do. Read all of 1 Peter. Sit down, read it leisurely, enjoy it. Sit down, read the entire book. It's only 5 chapters. It will not take you that long, but read the entire book, and then read chapter 1 again and read it, okay, because we're going to talk about the introduction. And again, we're going to allude back to that question I asked earlier in class. How valuable is your faith? Okay? How strong is it? How rewarding is it? Okay, thank you.